all the latest on gadgets and stuff with KFI's resident handsome nerd.
It's Tech Tuesday with Rich DeMuro.
And good morning, Bill Handel here. It is a Tuesday morning, December 7th. Some of the big stories that we are covering, since it is 80 years ago today, the attack on Pearl Harbor. A few dozen survivors are gathering at the site of the bombing 80 years ago. And the survivors are all in their mid to late 90s or north of 100. How long do you think that's going to last when the last survivor of World War II? It's not going to be too very long. It's time for Tech Tuesday with Rich DeMuro. Rich, KTLA's tech reporter and our tech reporter. Rich on tech.tv is his website. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning to you, Bill.
Here is a story I want to discuss with you, and I think we're both on the same page.
Wow.
Last year, people spent $30 billion on NFTs, NFTs being non-fungible tokens. A little bit of data on a computer. A bit of code on a computer, and $30 billion was spent on that. You want to explain that one to me?
Well, I mean, let's take it out a little bit. Think about a little bit of code on your iPhone, how big the app store is. I mean, people are buying 99-cent apps every single day, in-app purchases. All of that is digital as well. So when you look at it that way, it's not all that odd that people are spending money on digital items. And so that's just a little bit of background. But NFT, we've heard so much about these. Like you said, non-fungible tokens. These are the digital equivalent of any sort of collectible. So, Beanie Babies, baseball cards, those are the easiest things in the real world. But just imagine that someone created something similar in the digital world, and they sell those, and people buy them, and they hold on to them. The big difference here is that your name or your identity is attached to these in a much more provable way than a baseball card. You lose a baseball card out of your backpack, it's gone. Someone else finds it, it's theirs. NFT, Bill, is all powered by the blockchain, which means they can verify the ownership of this digital thing.
Okay, fair enough. So you own it. But at least a baseball card, you're looking at it, holding it, touching it. Same thing with coins, same thing with a Beanie Baby, same thing with a tulip in Holland in the 1600s. But this is me convincing you that what I have created is valuable, even though there really isn't anything there. It's my creation, and it's only yours. Therefore, I should charge you a ton of money. One of the examples being that you can buy from a major artist. I think Banksy did it, here I'm drawing a picture, I guess, on the computer, and it's only yours. You own the picture, and it's only on the screen, and I want $5 million, and people line up to pay it.
Yeah. I mean, like this report said, I mean, they spent nearly $30 billion on these things. So CryptoPunks is a popular NFT, originator. And then the big website that people buy these things on is called OpenSea. That's Open S-E-A. And there's all kinds of activity. I mean, every day you can buy things for, inexpensive. You can buy things for millions. And a lot of this, or all of it, is pretty much purchased with cryptocurrency, which, we've seen the ups and downs of crypto. But, some people made a lot of money on crypto, and so they don't mind spending as much. But Bill, back to your idea of like something that's only digital and might not be worth something. Let me give a really easy example. Let's say that you have zero pictures of your kids ever, except for one digital image of your child. Let's say everything gets lost or ruined or something, and you have one picture on your phone of your child. Imagine how much value that picture has to you, that digital item. And so, again, that's a very extreme example, but there is inherent value in that picture. It's only valuable to you because it's your child, but, again, there is value there, and you don't want to lose that or delete it or whatever.
But
and
again,
so same thing here.
But, again, that is, and it's, incidentally, it's only to you that the value,
right.
I mean, you don't care about a picture of my kids.
Okay, that's fair, but imagine the value of any of these other digital things are really the person who buys it and the person who wants to buy it from them. So if a big musical artist said, hey, we're going to do an NFT of a, you know, a digital ticket of our concert, like, I may not care if I don't care about that artist,
right?
But someone else might care and then want to purchase that. Or it's just fun to have it collectible.
Yeah, and a collectible on a computer screen. By the way, can you turn around and sell them? I mean, and what do you do? Let's say you have a drawing of a piece of art. And it's only on your computer. I'm assuming you have, you can put it on the wall with the TV screen. Mm-hmm. But when you sell it, you still have it, don't you?
Well, that's what's interesting. You can make a copy of these things, but just like you can make a copy of anything in the world, there's an original. So there's a lot of Mona Lisas hanging on walls around the world. There's only one original. And so that's the big difference here. Now, the whole profit thing, like if... You know, like let's say you have an NFT that you purchase from me and you start copying it and selling it. You know, I can say, hey, Bill, you can't sell those. That's mine. I have the rights to make this thing and to sell it, or, you know, depending on what the rights are. So it gets really interesting because you're right. It's so odd that it's like a digital thing, but we have to apply some of these real world rules to it as well. And by the way, if you want to display your digital NFT artwork, Bill, on the wall, there is an item called a mural canvas, a $350 display. It's from Netgear, you know, the guys that make the routers. They've got a display you put on your wall, and you can display your crypto art on it.
Well, there you go. That's worth how much money?
$350.
No, I'm talking about the art itself. Millions? Depending on, yeah, I know. And you get, okay. It's just, you know, again, it's, and that one actually makes more sense than cryptocurrency, which I have yet to understand other than people want it. And I'm trying to come up, it's like religion. I'm trying to come up with a religion and get people to follow me and explain to them why it's so important for them to pay for me to have a private jet. because God, through me, is telling you, give Bill enough money to buy a private jet. You know, it's just hard understanding any of it.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, yeah. And if I go into your house, am I going to find all the checks falling out of the wall?
Yeah, that's good point. Good point. We're going to come right back with Rich DeMuro, our tech reporter. This is KFI AM 640. Let's check in with Jennifer. KFI AM 640, Bill Handel. Tuesday morning, December 7th, some of the big stories that we are covering. Devin Nunes, California congressman, total Trump supporter. I mean, just down the line, he's leaving Congress to, strangely enough, be the CEO of Trump's new social platform, like Twitter. It's going to be Twitter-like. He's going to tweet or twit. I think that's the new verb that we're going to use. Back we go to Rich Rich DeMuro. Rich on tech.tv is his social handle. All right, Rich, again, thanks for joining us. Here's something interesting. You take your phone in for repair. What is the risk that you're taking?
Well, the risk is that the person repairing it might have access to anything and everything on your phone. But also, you know, a lot of these phones serve as sort of what's called a two-factor authentication. So when I log into a website, my code goes to that device to, you know, say to verify that it's me. And so we've seen a couple of high-profile issues here with both the iPhone and now the Google Pixel, where people have sent in their phones to be repaired. And at some point along the way, we're not sure if these are, you know, the official repair place or someone at, you know, delivery companies, but, you know, people are getting their phones gone through. You know, these repair people are going through these people's phones, and they shouldn't be. You know, there's definitely systems in place to keep this from happening. But the reality is, if you're sending your phone in for repair, you should be on guard and understand that anything that's on that phone could get out into the open. Now, how do you protect yourself from this? So I'll give you my example. I brought my laptop in to get a repair one time, and the technician just, you know, in the scheme of like taking my laptop from me, said, okay, and what's your password? And you're like, wait, hold on. What do you mean, what's my password? Can't you do this repair without my password? And they said, well, it makes things a lot tougher. And I said, no. No one gets my password for my computer. And I didn't give it to them. And of course, you know, things were okay.
Yeah, but it makes sense to give him password, because how else do you get into the computer? And you're right, saying that there are ways of getting in.
Well, look, I mean, that should keep your information safe from them, and they should be able to complete most repairs on your computer without actually accessing the data on your computer. Now, in some cases, a lot of this information is erased off of your device, which is a whole other thing. I mean, when you're sending your device in, there's an understanding that it may not come back. Number one, it may not be the same device. Number two, they have the right to wipe all the information off your device. But the reality is, I mean, the big takeaway here is that if you're recycling a computer, if you're sending in a phone for repair, if you're doing anything where you're leaving your device outside of your hands, there's a chance that the information on that device can go to someone or end up somewhere that you don't want. And that's a problem. And so you just have to be aware of this possibility. And when you leave your stuff somewhere, think about that. And if they say, hey, can I have your passcode before we finish work on this phone? Just say no. And if they can't fix it, bring it to another place. Or if they say, okay, well, we can't guarantee that your phone is going to have the data on it, you know, make sure it's backed up before.
All right. That's fair. I mean, for example, mine is backed up. I'm assuming you use any of the backup services. I've lost my phone, for example, have gone to Verizon and bought a new phone, and they were able to download everything that I had, all my contacts, my photos, everything.
Yeah, a lot of that stuff is backed up in the cloud. But now here, Bill, here's the other scenario, okay? Let's say you're getting your phone repaired because it doesn't turn on. Okay, so now what do you do? I mean, you got to send it in, right, when you can't clear the information off of it. And so that's what happened to this latest person, where she could not – she's actually a video game designer, and she sent her phone in to get repaired, a Pixel phone, to Google, and she couldn't clear off her phone. She knew she wanted to, but she couldn't because the phone wouldn't turn on. And so that's what happened. She sent it in, and next thing you know, accounts were being logged into. They were looking through her pictures, and not a very good situation there. But, you know, Google has come out and said, hey, this is not how we operate. We're going to look into our systems. And, of course, we've seen these issues. I mean, there's so many repair places out there. It's not like a standard that these people go through your phone, but there's always a bad apple here and there.
Are you better off going to, if you have, for example, an iPhone, going to an Apple store, and I guess you're paying more money for any repair there than an independent store?
No, I don't think independence. I mean, I think independence in some cases. I brought my laptop one time to an independent and one time to Apple. So, I mean, it just sort of depends. I don't think the independents are any more evil than the Apples of the world. I mean, I think you go where you're comfortable. And in some cases, you might get better customer service going to a local place.
As long as
it's an authorized place. I think that's the big thing.
Oh, got it. I'm just talking about security. You know, one of the things that I do whenever my car, I need a part of my car, I'm fanatic. I go to the dealership, and I know I'm paying the price for it, but I want to make sure. And that's the way it goes. Incidentally, my phone also didn't turn on, and I ended up going to the Verizon store where I bought the phone, and it just refused to turn on. And the salesperson said, try pushing this button to turn it on.
And
it worked.
There you go.
Yeah.
You know what? To your defense, Bill, I will tell you, when it comes to the latest devices, like especially the new iPhones and the new Apple Watches, they're not the easiest phones to turn off, because they've gotten rid of so many buttons on these phones. One, like the side button on the iPhone, does everything. It activates Siri, it calls emergency services, and if you press and hold it, it doesn't necessarily turn your phone off anymore. And so it might bring up the slider eventually, but typically for me, I have to press the volume up and the power button to bring up the little system to tell you, hey, let's turn off your phone.
Wow.
But you know, so I give you credit for that. I don't think that was totally
great. I feel much smarter now. Rich, thank you. We'll talk again next week. The website is richontech.tv, where you get all things tech. Rich, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll catch you on Tuesday. Coming up, Handle on the News Late Edition, right here on a Tuesday, December 7th. This is KFI. That is Jennifer Jones Lee.
Handle on the News. Late Edition.
Handle on the News.
And now, here's Bill Handel.
Good morning. Bill Handel here. And the morning crew, sans Wayne Resnick, who will be coming back on Thursday. And let's do it. It is that time. Handel on the News, late edition with Jennifer. No Wayne until Thursday. And me, lead story. Well, a few dozen survivors of Pearl Harbor expected to gather today, December 7th, at the site of the Japanese bombing, the port of Pearl Harbor. And one of them, Herb Elfring, who's 99, said he's glad to return. Well, think about this. Pearl Harbor was 80 years ago today. And so probably the youngest person who was there and was killed, a service person, was probably, what, 16? And there were a lot of 16-year-olds that simply lied about their age to get into the Army, the Navy. So based on that, the youngest would be 96.
This guy, okay, let's see. I've got a cut from David Russell. He was 21 years old, so he's 100 now. He was in the Navy on the USS Oklahoma when the bomb started to fall.
When we talk about it, people don't believe us. So we're trying to talk about it.
He actually jumped off the ship and swam to safety before the ship capsized, and he is in Hawaii for the remembrance today.
And about 30 survivors, 100 other veterans are expected to join him. As you can imagine, if they're north of 95, 96, a couple of years from now, there's going to be nobody left. And it's a very, very moving place to go.
I don't know if you've ever been
going to the Arizona and above, and the oil still bubbling up.
Yeah.
And it's falling apart. I mean, it's 20, 30 years from now, there'll be nothing left.
You know, I think it's fascinating to talk to some of these veterans who are in their 90s and, you know, even the low 100s. Their stories are, it's so funny because in many cases, maybe their current memories are gone, but their memories of those days when they were in the military are crystal clear.
Well, yeah. I mean, short-term memory disappears pretty quickly.
But those long-term memories.
Long-term memories are there. You can remember things that happened when you were just a child.
They talk about the smells that day. They talk about, you know, how things felt. It was crazy.
Rosebud.
All right. New York City is set to give voting rights to people who are non-citizens. And the legally documented voting age non-citizens, they say, comprise nearly a 1 in 9 of the city's 7 million people who are of voting age.
Yeah. Now, this is interesting because obviously they can't vote in national elections because you have to be a citizen, or statewide elections. You have to be a citizen. What New York is saying, and it's going to happen, by the way, because there doesn't seem to be a lot of opposition, that if you are here legally, you can vote for city elections, and the city has the power to do that. Absolutely. And I have mixed feelings about that. I really do. I mean, people who are here legally are, for the most part, Americans. How many have applied? I would argue those who have applied for citizenship should be able to vote. That's where I would draw the line.
Well, yeah, because this is very personal for you, considering your family came here and earned their citizenship.
Absolutely. And it's one of those where, I mean, they didn't wait a minute. It's like getting your driver's license when you're 16 on your birthday. My folks applied for citizenship exactly 5 years after, I mean, to the day after arriving in the United States with their green card.
Yeah. We met a woman the other day who, I forget what we asked. She was from Vietnam, and we were asking her, you know, like, oh, how long have you been in the United States? And she launches into this story. And I mean, it was like she was showing us her certificate from Stanford, the way that she was. And then I got my citizenship and this. I mean, she was so proud.
Very exciting.
Yeah. Of that
and
moment.
One of the most moving moments is a naturalization ceremony. Federal judges love that.
Oh, yeah.
That's their favorite thing to do on the planet, is to swear in new citizens.
All right, they have closed the Emmett Till investigation. Emmett Till was the 14-year-old who in 1955 was accused of whistling at and grabbing a white woman in Mississippi. And it turns out then just maybe, I want to say 3 years ago, there was a book that came out where the woman who he allegedly grabbed admitted that that didn't happen,
that she
lied about it.
And now she's saying that it did happen.
Right.
I don't think it was verified that she had recanted.
That's the problem.
It had not been corroborated. So they closed it up. And by the way, he was killed in 1955. And three whites were tried for the murder and acquitted by an all-white jury. And less than a year later, they all admitted they had done it.
but there's nothing you can do after an acquittal. I'll tell you, in the 50s, can you imagine an all-white jury in the South? Yeah, you're going to certainly convict on that basis, aren't you?
Former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, as we talked about earlier in the show, will no longer cooperate with the House committee that's investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol. They said, we agreed to provide thousands of pages of documents, and Mr. Meadows was willing to appear voluntarily. And then now he says that actions by the Select Committee have made such an appearance untenable.
Well, he's got a point, because what the Select Committee is doing is it is so broad in its subpoenaing. I mean, every document having any possible kind of sort of connection, even to the point where the subpoena issues again, the receipt from the deli that a friend of the uncle of one of the staffers. I mean, it goes on and on and on. And then Trump's claim of executive privilege, which he's going to lose, by the way. He's arguing executive privileges and all of those missives, all of those documents that are connected to January 6th, those are all under the protection of executive privilege. And the issue is, does executive privilege extend to a previous president? And the general consensus is no, it does not. It is current president that can argue executive privilege.
These guys like Mark Meadows and Steve Bannon, though, that's the reason that they're saying that they can, skirt this subpoena.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Because of Trump's executive privilege at the time.
Yeah, and when he loses, executive privilege is no longer applied or no longer applies because the courts are going to rule that way, then they get to figure out another way not to comply. And what they'll do is they'll suck up a contempt of Congress charge. And nothing ever happens with that. Anyway, Steve Bannon just said, screw you.
And to their credit, why wouldn't you? If you could just keep saying that over and over,
right,
assuming that nothing's ever going to happen. If there are no consequences actions, why wouldn't you continue?
There are virtually no consequences. It's just a slap on the wrist. It's actually a statement. The only issue the committee is deciding what kind of paper does the release is printed on. Let's go ahead and take a break. We'll come back and more. We'll finish up Handle on the News late edition. Let's check in with Jennifer.
Is that you, Santa Claus? Gifts I'm preparing.
And good morning, Bill Handle here on a Tuesday morning, December 7th, as we continue and finish Handle on the News late edition. Jennifer Jones Lee, Wayne is not here until Thursday, and me.
We have another person who has been subpoenaed by the January 6th committee. This time it's former Vice President Mike Pence's chief of staff. And his name is Mark Short, and he has given no indication he will rebuff the committee's subpoena, but he says he will respect any invocation of executive privilege by former President Trump, which to me means he hasn't said no, but he hasn't said yes either. And if he says no, that's what he will cite.
Except if the court rules that executive privilege does not apply to President Trump, that all that is off the table. And President Biden said, go at it. You know, get all the information you want to the committee. What a surprise that one is.
Well, there was a guy in Jackson, Mississippi, who was executed last month for killing his estranged wife. And just before he was killed, he confessed to a cold case from 2007. David Neal Cox told his attorney he killed his sister-in-law, Felicia Cox, in 2007 and gave detailed instructions where investigators could find the remains.
Yeah, and he was been a longtime suspect, so they just confirmed that it was him, or he admitted it, and they're wrapping that case up.
That's interesting to me, because usually they take stuff like that to the grave.
Right, and usually it's this one is fairly easy. You close the case when close the person, as in he's dead. And so is the case.
It's pretty final. The Ohio Supreme Court has ruled that a couple in Huron County is not liable after a truck hit their, as they call it, fortified mailbox and flipped in 2016. Now, the person who hit the mailbox had injuries that paralyzed him. And so what they were trying to decide was whether or not the homeowner was liable for the crash that injured the driver for the rest of his life. And they said that landowners owe no duty to protect drivers who leave the regularly traveled portion of the road and hit an object in the right of way.
Yeah. And by the way, the plaintiff is absolutely right. Had it been a regular mailbox, he would have been fine. And instead, it was a fortified, which no one knows what that is, probably a concrete stanchion where the mailbox is. And you put the mailbox inside that concrete pillar, which happens all the time. And the court said, OK, fine. You know, tough luck. You hit the wrong. Mailbox. No duty. You can have all the fortified mailboxes you want because obviously there's no law against it. So they're out of luck. That's a handle on the law story that I'm going to use. Trust me.
When I was a kid, we lived on this really rural road. People used to come along and whack our newspaper box all the time. They'd shatter it. It was just a piece of plastic on a piece of wood. My dad's a welder, and so he went to work one day and came home with a fortified newspaper box, which was made out of a piece of steel pipe on a piece of steel pole.
All right, so that helped, didn't it?
Needless to say, somebody came by and tried to whack it, and I guarantee that person is probably still ringing from their baseball bat hitting that steel today.
Excellent.
There's a woman who has been arrested in North Carolina after preparing to smoke marijuana live on Facebook. So the sheriff's department was notified that this woman, Candace Keene, was preparing to smoke marijuana live stream. Investigators looked at the social media account and they were able to observe the video, and investigators went to the home of Candace Keene and talked to her about the weed that was seen in the video, which she didn't deny. So investigators found and collected all kinds of marijuana and controlled prescription medication that wasn't prescribed to her during their search of the home. She was then taken to jail on charges of possession and intent to manufacture or sell.
All right. And she was in the car, threatened to purposely urinate as opposed to accidentally urinate in the vehicle. Somehow she was charged with that. You can't say, I guess in North Carolina, the crime is if I threaten to pee in the car, therefore I am guilty of threatening to pee in the car. Welcome to North Carolina.
Is there something on the books?
I don't have any idea, but it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, actually, because I think you can. Yeah, if you're not peeing, you're not peeing.
All right, here go the lawsuits. But it's Chris Cuomo preparing to sue CNN for more than $18 million over his contract. So apparently he's hired lawyers. He had the remainder of a 4-year contract signed last year. And it'll come down to what that contract says, right? Because if they can say that it was conduct unbecoming or whatever.
Yeah, that's basically it. I mean, the whole issue is the morals clause.
Yeah.
And we all sign one working here. And what it does, it gives the company the leeway, the right to determine what actually influences the company's reputation. And it's pretty wide. It's pretty wide ranging. I mean, it's up to the company to determine, what you did is hurting our reputation. And that usually is held up unless it is totally arbitrary, totally capricious. Or someone who had done exactly the same thing was not tagged, and all of a sudden you are. So, I mean, there are some exceptions, but this one, how do you argue that he has put CNN in a bad light for what he did? This is a dead bang winner for CNN, and they're not going to pay. And now we know how much he was paid, about $6 million a year, which is not a bad living, to say the least.
Okay. I have a weird question for you. In this story, I read a phrase I'd never heard before. It says lawyers from the white shoe firm Kravitz, Swain & Moore. What's a white shoe firm?
It's a high-end firm.
Okay, that's what I figured.
Yeah.
Swanky firm. Okay.
Yeah, it could have been. Yeah, swanky.
You okay. Know,
it's,
never heard that before.
White shoe. There's blue suede shoe firms, too, but they're in the South. They're usually in Tennessee.
And they boogie.
Yeah, usually out of Memphis. All right, guys, we are done. Coming up, a Handle History segment, Pearl Harbor. And it wasn't just the Japanese attacking Pearl Harbor on a day. There's a huge backstory to it. And the Jewish connection to Pearl Harbor, which very few people know about. And I do. What a shocker. And that will come right up. KFI AM 640. Live everywhere on the iHeartRadio app.